This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 16th episode. Today, we review a large international study from the JCENM in the primary aldosteronism field, which will help us understand if the diagnostic evaluation of primary aldo can be simplified. This question is one that many endocrinologists have been asking recently, making this an important article for us to look at. Given its observational design, our typical close look at the methodology will be particularly important here. Today, not only are we lucky enough to have two endocrinologists join us on Endocrine Feedback Loop, as is usual, but with us today are two adrenal experts. Before I introduce them, as a brief reminder, I host this podcast, but spend most of my time working as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt, where I direct our outpatient operations and help direct the fellowship program. Joining us for the second time in our virtual recording studio is our regular contributor, is Salila Cura from Colombia. Importantly for us today, she holds both key educational and clinical roles there, working as an advisory dean in the medical school and as the medical director for their adrenal center, in addition to many other positions. Our guest expert today hails from Michigan's outstanding adrenal center. Adina Turku is a clinical and research expert in adrenal disorders, including Cushing's, FEO, and CAH. But importantly for us today, primary aldosteronism is one of her areas of expertise. So as you can tell, we have the perfect pair of endocrinologists with us to help us understand this article. As is usual, everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today's article is Identification of Surgically Curable Primary Aldosteronism by Imaging in a Large Multi-Ethnic International Study, which is a forthcoming article in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Gian Paolo Rossi from the University of Padova in Italy served as the first author, though there were numerous authors from institutions throughout Europe, Asia, North America, and Australia. So Salila, let's start with having you lead us through the author's introduction, as well as you and Adina helping us understand the current landscape of primary aldosteronism. So Salila?
Great. Thank you, Chase. And thank you for the kind introduction and for having me here again. I'm excited to discuss this interesting article. And to begin with, you know, primary aldosteronism is the most common surgically curable form of secondary arterial hypertension. And although it's relatively rarely identified, and I think we should start by discussing that, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about both Adina and Chase, why this is the case, why it's so relatively rarely identified in the populations that we see.
Yes, this is a super complex topic that I would love to help dissect one day in full. So to begin with, we should say that several international expert guidelines, including the guidelines from Endocrine Society and the American College of Cardiology in conjunction with American Heart Association, recommend screening for primary aldo in high-risk groups. And that includes patients with treatment-resistant hypertension and those with hypertension and hypokalemia. Yet, we don't really know why this doesn't happen often enough. What we know is that PA screening is pursued in under 3% of at-risk populations. We have, however, limited data to objectively quantify the contribution of various barriers in the way of broader screening for PA. We can point out a few apparent causes. First, the clinical presentation of PA, which cannot be distinguished from any other forms of hypertension, including your run-of-the-mill primary hypertension. These patients don't typically have hypertension emergencies or edema. And although physicians tend to consider PA more often when hypokalemia is present, under 30% of patients with primary aldo will have hypokalemia. Second, despite compelling evidence indicating that PA is a common form of hypertension, PA is still perceived as a rare disease by many. Third, testing for PA, which is a multi-step process that often intimidates many physicians. And other barriers include time constraints and limited access to resources. The sheer number of patients with hypertension seen by frontline clinicians is really overwhelming. So hypertension affects almost 1 in 2 adults in the U.S., and up to 20% of patients who receive antihypertensive medications have apparent treatment-resistant hypertension. So in concert, all of these factors explain why the vast majority of patients with PA never get to be identified.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think looking ahead at this paper, and we'll get into how it might answer these, but I think several of these potential barriers that Adina has pointed out, this paper is looking at to see, well, can we remove some of those barriers? Can we make this simpler? Can we make this less resource intensive? And so potentially allow this common condition to be identified more. So I think that this was one of the reasons why we thought this would be important to look at, to see if we can find some solutions to overcoming these barriers.
Yeah, those are all great points. And, you know, as we all know, referral for adrenalectomy requires demonstration of a unilateral cause of the primary aldosteronism. And, you know, most patients before they're referred for adrenalectomy have adrenal vein sampling or AVS. And it's the key test that's recommended by the available guidelines to identify unilateral PA. And it's technically challenging and difficult to interpret. And as a result, it's only available in a few centers, and it represents a major hurdle for subtyping of patients with primary aldosteronism. So, Adina, I was hoping we could briefly overview AVS and then really kind of discuss and what we do at our respective institutions to help identify these patients that would be good candidates for adrenalectomy.
Sure, Salila. So you correctly pointed out AVS is technically challenging. So its success is reliant on interventional radiologists who not only performs any interventions on a regular basis, but specifically adrenal vein sampling. So we need to have a high volume adrenal vein sampling center. And there are numerous points of heterogeneity among referral centers, both regarding the procedure protocol itself and also the interpretation of the hormonal data that we receive, which can lead to some variability in ascertaining the PA subtype. So if we speak about the procedure protocol itself, one variable is the use of cosentropin. This is a synthetic ACTH. It's used in most US centers, but it's used rarely in Europe. And where it's used, cosentropin administration can be done either as a bolus or a continuous infusion, and some centers combine the two. Then the timing of adrenal vein catheterization after cosentropin stimulation can vary, which can impact the results as well. Blood sampling can be done either simultaneously from both adrenals after catheters are placed in each of the two veins, and then, or in some centers, is done sequentially, moving the catheter from one vein to the other one. So this can generate further opportunity for hormonal fluctuations, particularly when cosentropin is not used. Regarding the data interpretation, centers have used different thresholds, and this, again, creates more opportunity for misclassification of PA patients.
Yeah, and I would say, Salila, to answer that other question you asked as far as how that's used, at least at Vanderbilt, I'd say we experience a lot of these barriers that are at other places. Is it's challenging to get folks through doing all these things, even though we have great interventional radiologists who do this. There's a lot of folks who are not interested in having all these procedures. It's a fairly exhaustive process for patients to go through all of these steps and get everything done. I would say the only thing, we'll look later on at the exact protocols that are used here, and I'd say the only thing that we do that might be slightly different is not necessarily always doing the imaging up front prior to having the AVS done. Sometimes it happens afterwards, but largely I think the process that Adina outlined and that we'll look at that was used here is very similar to one that we utilize here.
We tend to also use a similar process of having the imaging done first and then the AVS. Although, interestingly, the imaging doesn't typically guide the AVS. The AVS is done similarly regardless of what the imaging shows. So it's an interesting point as to why the imaging is done first or how useful the imaging is in general. To move on, thus far, the diagnostic accuracy of imaging has been investigated in only single center surveys and in a meta-analysis. And for the most part, they've lacked an unambiguous diagnosis of unilateral PA as a reference. There was a prospective randomized study which reported no differences in the burden of antihypertensive medications and quality of life indices between CT-based and AVS-based strategy to select patients for adrenalectomy. However, since only half the patients in each diagnostic study arm underwent adrenalectomy, the study was underpowered to show significant outcome differences. And Adina, I'm curious to hear about your thoughts on this data and this study.
Yeah, so for the primary outcome of this study, which was to compare the intensity of antihypertensive treatment 1 year after either CT or AVS-guided adrenalectomy, the power of the study was adequate, and it was calculated based on this primary outcome, but the primary outcome in itself has questionable clinical relevance, and this is primarily because postoperatively, treatment with mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist was allowed in both groups. And expectedly, these are the preferred targeted therapy for primary aldo, and we would expect that they could effectively control blood pressure in patients with an aldosterone-producing adenoma who might have been misdirected to surgery. But I would say that a more important outcome, which is a biochemical cure of PA following surgery, was achieved almost twice as often in patients who had AVS-directed adrenalectomy versus those who had surgery based on CT. However, for this outcome, the study was underpowered to evaluate the difference. We have, however, another large multi-center international study that was done to compare CT versus AVS post-operative outcome, and they used systematic criteria to assess these post-surgical outcomes, called now PASO criteria. And in this study, which is quite large, almost 1,000 patients included, patients who had surgery directed by CT had failure of cure of PA a lot more often. So 12% of these patients failed to have PA cure after surgery versus only 2% in those with AVS-guided surgery. So it was a substantial difference between the two.
Thank you for reviewing that. And I think that brings to light why this study is important to review, because there still is a lot of uncertainty regarding the, scanning and imaging versus AVS. So this study in the Adrenal Vein Sampling International Study, or AVIS-2, recruited primary ALDO patients who underwent AVS in major referral centers on four continents because they sought a surgical cure. A sizable proportion of the patients recruited underwent adrenalectomy, which was AVS-guided in the majority and based on clinical indications in a tiny subset. The presence of unilateral PA in the majority, the presence of unilateral PA was conclusively established based on biochemical and or clinical cure at follow-up. Their main hypothesis was, one, imaging will allow for accurate detection of unilateral primary aldosteronism, and two, imaging positive PA patients show a better clinical outcome post-adrenalectomy than imaging negative PA patients.
All right, thank you, Salila and Adina, for helping outline where we're at here. And I think it's really helpful just that we have a common issue. We don't have a very good way of trying to figure out who has this condition. And so I think that this paper will look at the methods here to really try to delve into how the authors tried to answer this question of, can we simplify this diagnostic process, and particularly with imaging. So before we jump into the particulars of this investigation, we're going to talk just a little bit in general about how assessments of diagnostic tests work. We were speaking in generalities, and there's different ways that these studies can be done, but a very common approach, as is used here, is that when you look at a diagnostic test to assess its accuracy, it tends to be a cross-sectional design. And that's what's used here. So it's important to know that these are not patients who are followed over time after they've been split into one group or another, waiting for the development of an outcome. These are folks that the data is collected at a relatively a single point of time, though it may take several days, particularly if there's several tests and then surgery and then surgical follow-up, but it's not following over prolonged amounts of time to get this data. So that's one important thing, cross-sectional design. I think the other thing that's really important to think about when you look at these studies is to understand what group is this being evaluated in. So using primary ALDO as an example, I think we would want to know, is this a group that was being investigated? This was folks with hypertension, and it really wasn't any more specific than that, or is this group potentially with some other indication, maybe resistant hypertension, needing multiple medications, or having had hypokalemia, or is it something even more specific than that? And then we'll look at this when we get into this paper in particular, but it is a much more specific group that's being utilized as the actual data to understand the accuracy of imaging. And so we'll need to think about that more, because that has a big impact on how we interpret the data. And the final thing that I wanted us to think about, because it's also going to be really important here, is understanding how a gold standard functions. This is something that is an aspect of any assessment of a diagnostic test, is that if you are investigating a test or a methodology or a procedure, you have to have something to compare it to say, is it just as good or is it worse than what we've done before? And there are different tests that can be used as that gold standard, but often they're the accepted criteria for defining something. So if you are looking at a new diagnostic test and you want to see if it's better because maybe it's cheaper or easier to do than the standard methodology, you have to compare it to that standard approach that's used to say, hey, is it as good as this or is it worse? Now, one of the problems can be, and we'll look at this later on, is that the gold standard itself is not necessarily always right. The way these tests work, you have to assume that it's always right. So that's a problem, because that's your comparison point, but it may not always be the case. And depending upon how you define it, we'll look at it here, is that there is clinical outcomes that are used to define that, there can be a lot of issues with that. So we always have to think about that is when you have a gold standard, could there be an issue with the gold standard itself that can affect the accuracy of the actual test that you're investigating? So all things to think about. We'll look at the methods here of this paper and come back to these, and I think that'll help us understand things a little bit better. So with this investigation in particular, the data was obtained from many years. We'll look here in the results of where all these patients came from, but when it was all the way from 2000 to 2017. So quite a few years of data here. And these were all subjects who had primary aldosteronism who underwent an AVS. And the way this protocol worked, this was alluded to in the introduction that we talked about, is that all of these individuals had imaging prior to the AVS. So they had both adrenal vein sampling and imaging. And I'll just point out as an aside that I do think it was a nice way that they built this protocol to investigate it further is that the imaging was done prior to having the AVS. And so you don't have to worry about potential bias there of the individuals who are interpreting this, knowing what the results of the AVS are when they're doing the imaging, interpreting the imaging. So I do think that was a nice feature that was a standard part of the protocol, imaging first and then AVS afterwards. We'll come back to that as well. The inclusion criteria were very broad. So you had to be an adult patient, so 18 years of age or older, and yet there had to be agreement by the center and its ethics committee to participate in this. So very broad criteria there. And now what we're going to think about is the gold standard that's utilized here. So the gold standard in this, so again, this is, they're going to look at this newer way of assessing things just using the imaging, but what they compare that to, the gold standard, is a diagnosis of unilateral primary aldosteronism, which is based, the way that is defined, is that it could only be assessed in those who underwent surgery with a full biochemical cure. So had a surgery and then afterwards had full normalization of their labs, which would be the aldosterone level, the aldo-renin ratio, and also the potassium levels, or you had to have complete cure of your elevated blood pressure. So that means you had to have your blood pressure be under 140 over 90 off of treatments. And so I think a few really important things to understand as we think about how that definition works there is that when we think about the group that's being assessed here, is that this really only applies to those who underwent surgery. Because they use this, you had to have been assessed surgically. So you could have undergone a surgery to be a part of this group. Is that by necessity, the investigators had to exclude all of those individuals who, for one reason or another, didn't end up undergoing surgery. So initially, quite a few subjects in the study, but that was really narrowed down by the time you got to those who underwent a surgery to whom this gold standard could be applied. So I think that'll be important. We're going to come back to that here, particularly in the discussion, to think about the impact that would have. I do think it's an important one that was defined in that way. But I did also want to get our group's thoughts on this. So Dina and Salila, what are your thoughts on using this criteria? For example, one question of why might they have included resolution of hypertension even if you didn't have resolution of your primary aldo biochemically? Any other thoughts? And Dina, we can start with you. Just your thoughts on use of this description, this criteria as the gold standard.
Sure. So we should start off by saying that the accuracy of the diagnosis has several potential pitfalls. So the diagnosis still remains debatable in the 30% of patients who were diagnosed with bilateral PA based on AVS, and we know that they had different AVS protocols across the participating centers. And then patients with lateralized PA could have been missed by some of the protocols, and because these patients never had surgery, the true subtype in this group is not 100% accurate. Now, coming back to your question regarding the postoperative outcome, as in the Spartacus trial we discussed earlier, we are presented with the blood pressure control after surgery rather than the biochemical outcome. And I think this was done out of necessity. Basically, most of these patients never have postoperative biochemical results. It can be because many patients are referred for adrenal vein sampling at these referral institutions and then never come back for follow-up. They are followed in the community. So in the absence of that information, they mostly relied on blood pressure. Now, blood pressure could be an acceptable surrogate for primary aldosteronism control, but we have two problems. One is the measurement of blood pressure. This is all in-office blood pressure measurements. They were not standardized. And considering the multifactorial nature of blood pressure, in itself, blood pressure cannot provide a reliable assessment of PA, right? Autonomous aldosterone production. If it's completely cured, that is a good indicator that surgery did help, though.
Good. So we'll come back to these criteria as we think about how to interpret the results. So Leela, in a little bit, is going to walk us through the results, and we'll see that it's a relatively small subset of individuals who had all of this information from their initial group that this gold standard could be applied to. So we're going to think about that impact and how that might have been different if they had used other criteria. So more to come on that. A couple of final points about the methodology, about definitions that are used here. So one is with the imaging. So as we're looking at here, these authors are trying to decide how helpful imaging alone would be to try to figure out who has primary ALDO. And a few definitions that I think that are key that we need to wrestle with here. So one, the authors decided that for them to be able to say that the subject had a nodule in the adrenal, that the nodule had to be at least 5 millimeters in diameter. And another important point that they made is that they decided to exclude or to at least ignore any component of adrenal hyperplasia. They had a few reasons for that. One being is that it is very difficult to come up with an agreed upon definition for that. And so because of the heterogeneity there, they thought that it was best to ignore that as far as a component of the imaging reports that they received. But I did want to get our thoughts on that. So both Leela and Dina, any thoughts that you all had on that criteria in particular? The exclusion of adrenal hyperplasia. It's understandable why they did that, but what impact might that have on how we interpret these results?
In regards to the cutoff for adrenal nodule, that is a tricky one. I actually had this discussion with a radiologist a few times because I found in some papers that the normal thickness of an adrenal limb would be around 6 millimeters. So for a 5 millimeter adrenal nodule to be observed in cross-sectional imaging, likely this would have to be a dedicated adrenal imaging and also for that nodule to be somewhat prominent outside of the limb. But there are many nodules that are within the cortex, deeper in the cortex, that might not be identified with even high-resolution cross-sectional imaging.
Yeah, I agree. I found that 5 millimeters was a little bit smaller than I would have anticipated, especially it probably leads to what we saw later in the study, that they saw more left-sided nodules and right-sided nodules, because it is harder to see smaller nodules on the right. And the 5 millimeters, it's to Adina's point that sometimes normal adrenals even appear a little bit larger than that. So I was a bit surprised by how small the cutoff was for how they defined nodularity.
That being said, I would say that this favors the CT group, if anything, so it shouldn't be biasing the study in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Good. And one final set of definitions here, and this is referring to the AVS. Adina walked us through a little bit about whether the AVS could be considered stimulated or unstimulated. So the criteria that they use, the selectivity indices, would be 2 is if it's an unstimulated study, and 4 if cosentropin was used here. And finally, they make a note of looking back to see and labeling those who underwent surgery as whether their surgery was AVS guided or non-AVS guided. And that's simply to denote for those who underwent surgery if they had a surgery that was based on a successful lateralization on the AVS, or whether it was a surgery to where the AVS didn't successfully lateralize, but then surgery was pursued for one reason or another. So we'll come back to what those numbers actually look like, but that's how they define that. So that's just a brief overview of the methodology that's used in this paper to help give us a sense of things. And now we're going to really dive into the numbers here and try to understand how the authors wrestled with some of these limitations. As we talked about, as Adina pointed out, there were several instances where they just had to come up with definitions and maybe didn't have all the information that they would have liked, but they had to wrestle with what they had. So we're going to think about those numbers and how these definitions that we've just looked at will impact the results that they found and the conclusions that they draw from those. So Leela, back over to you to walk us through the results that the authors present here.
Sure. So the patients were recruited in 19 centers on 4 continents, so in North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. There were 1,625 patients that were analyzed. 1,067 were recruited retrospectively from 2000 to 2012, and 558 were enrolled prospectively from 2013 to 2015. And there was no statistically significant differences of clinical features. 74% of the patients were white. And with regards to other things in Table 1, Adina, I was hoping you could speak to us a little bit more about the DRC and how you found those results and how they compare to our clinical practice of usually many of us check PRA and not DRC. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. So if we look at these values, they are suppressed renin values. And in conjunction with disproportionately elevated aldosterone concentrations, they would be typical for frank PA. But we, as you said, we should remind our listeners that the manuscript here presents direct renin mass concentrations versus PRA. And most clinicians are used to plasma renin activity and the respective units. And for a PRA, suppressed renin would be considered below 1 nanogram per mL per hour. So here is the distinction between the units and the assay used. Also, the initial guidelines for aldosterone renin ratio recommendations were constructed using PRA values. But across the world, many laboratories are transitioning from PRA to DRC, primarily because of faster turnaround time and also consistency on the lower end of the assay. So if you look at these values, these are really low numbers for renin. We had assays for PRA where numbers were suppressed, were reported at the very low end of the spectrum, but the assay would take a long time. And we should also mention the caveat of distorting the ARR if the PRA number would report below 0.6, because suddenly that ratio could be influenced tenfold by a suppressed renin between, say, 1 and 0.1. I should also say that in most labs, the conversion from a PRA to DRC can be done by a factor of 1 to 8 or 10. I've seen as high as 14, but in our lab, 1 to 10 would be the conversion. So if you need to do that for your outside labs, you can also do the reverse if you're most familiar with PRA.
Great, thank you. And so about 1,311 or about 81% of the patients had full imaging data. So most 87% underwent CT only, 8% had MR only, and 5% had both CT and MR. So I did want to discuss the impact of nearly 20% of patients missing imaging data and whether what impact this has on how we should interpret the study.
Yeah, and I think this will be an important thing. We're going to think about this at multiple points along the way, is this idea of missing data. And I do think it's a reality of when you do these large studies that are driven by databases and have numerous institutions involved, is that you're often stuck dealing with whatever information that you have. So it is a lot of patients, so 20% to not have the imaging available that was done. The protocol was that all of these individuals had imaging first and then had an ABS. So it is challenging that we don't have that for so many people. Though at least one nice thing that I liked that the authors did, they looked to see, they compared those who had the imaging versus those that didn't have the imaging and looked at those patient characteristics to try to see if there was any difference there that might suggest that there was actually a bias, that the groups were different because we missed out on having that information and didn't see any obvious explanation for that. So we don't know for sure. You can't look at all of the important elements of that, but it's at least somewhat reassuring that it may not be biasing the results, but at least something that you have to worry about when you have that many subjects that are missing data.
And 34% of the patients had no detectable adrenal nodules and 7% had bilateral nodules at imaging. So that's 41% of patients without a unilateral nodule and 59% with a unilateral nodule. And nodules were more common on the left and the right. Unilateral PA was the final diagnosis for 28%. So of the 1,311 patients, 369 of them, and bilateral PA for 30%. And there was no final diagnosis for 42%. So of the 1,311, 551 did not have a final diagnosis. So I'm curious to hear both your thoughts on the possible impact of missing final data on this many patients.
From my point of view, that's the largest limitation of the most important limitation of this study. And again, it might have to do with patients being followed up in their local centers. What this suggests, and unfortunately, it reflects the reality, and many of the cohorts published on patients with primary aldosteronism are lacking such data, not only hormonal data, but in this case also follow-up blood pressure data. So it's a very small proportion of the patients included, only 28% in whom we had some sort of information after surgery. At least from the data that we are given in this manuscript, it appears that patients that had follow-up versus those who did not have follow-up are relatively similar in terms of age and other demographics and even severity of primary aldosteronism. But we cannot extrapolate the data from the smaller group under a third of the patients who had follow-up to the rest of the cohort. So that's a little bit problematic here.
Yeah, and I think it's always important to keep this information in mind when we think about these large studies. I am just speaking in general. I think often the studies that are based on these databases will list up front and center, these are how many patients in our database. But I think this is really the important information that you need. How many people did you actually have enough data on to come up with a conclusion and use them in your final analysis? So now, and not to say that 369 folks is not a lot. That still is a good amount for a study like this, but is definitely far under that 1,311 that they had some of that initial data on.
Yeah, those are great points. And in the 369 patients with unilateral PA, the diagnosis was missed at imaging in 22%, so 82 of the 369. And who, and basically 15 of them had bilateral nodules and 67 had no nodules. So if imaging alone had been used for subtype differentiation, these patients would have been denied a potentially curative operation and the removal of the wrong gland would have occurred in 6%, so 21 of the 369. And the nodule site associated with the highest diagnostic accuracy was 1.6 centimeters or 16 millimeters. And it has a specificity of 82%, but a low sensitivity of 43%. And the clinical outcome, so the proportion of cured, markedly improved, and mildly improved cases did not differ significantly between the imaging positive and the imaging negative patients.
Thanks, Salila. So now we're going to transition into the discussion here, and we'll focus on initially the conclusions that the authors come up with. So and I'll try to distinguish here the author's conclusions, and then if there's anything that we would add to that, if we would explain that further, or if we might disagree with those findings. So first of all, authors, their main finding that they came up with in summary is they said that imaging missed 34% of nodules in unilateral primary aldo, and also showed bilateral nodules in 7% of those cases. The authors point out that if the imaging had been done sooner in the diagnostic process, it would have missed a third of these PA patients. And also based on other data that's out there, they conclude that it would have identified numerous false positives, so that it would have been even more problematic than when it showed up in their protocol here. So a few comments about the diagnostic accuracy. So again, this was a study that was looking at the diagnostic accuracy of using imaging. So a few conclusions that the authors drew from this. So when they looked at the receiver operating characteristics, that curve, the area under the curve, which is what you're trying to understand of how good of a test this is, it's a fairly low number, just 0.636. And as the authors described that, it's only slightly better than a coin flip. So not great information that you would get from using imaging as opposed to just randomly choosing which gland that you're going to remove. And so they point out that if imaging had been used instead of an AVS, that 22% of individuals would have missed a curative surgery and 6% of individuals would have had the wrong adrenal gland removed. And this is where I would come back and say, well, thinking about how this study is designed, and that in particular to look at that gold standard, it had to be those who had undergone surgery. So that was required to know for sure whether this was going to be a true positive or a false positive, to use some of those terminology that is utilized in these assessments. And because they defined it as those who had only undergone surgery because they needed a pathology diagnosis, you missed all of those individuals who didn't end up undergoing surgery for one reason or another. So even though we're going to look at some of these numbers here and be underwhelmed, or at least the authors were underwhelmed with how helpful this was, I think actually the numbers look even better than they would otherwise. I think if it was more broadly defined, which would have lots of limitations to doing that, that we would be even less impressed with the helpfulness of imaging in this situation. But to go on with what the authors point out here, so they say of the surgically cured patients, over 25% of those individuals had a non-diagnostic AVS. and that the imaging was negative in 40% of these cases. So I think one of the things that we want to start trying to think about is when imaging might be useful. So in this situation, I'm going to ask Adina, is if you have a non-diagnostic AVS, but for some reason you are really wanting to pursue a surgery that the patient is very much interested in surgical cure, would this be an instance to where you, imaging might be helpful? It was negative still in 40% of cases, but if you're not guided by AVS, it's hard to know exactly what you would be guided toward if you're using, or what criteria you're using for a surgery.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question, Chase. So a population in which we are very comfortable using imaging are patients under age of 35. And that is because in this age group, we don't commonly see incidentally found non-functioning adrenal adenomas. However, above this age, the prevalence of adrenal nodules increases with age proportionally, and most of these nodules are in fact non-functional adenomas. The vast majority would be non-functional, which stays at the basis of why cross-sectional imaging, which is a non-functional method of diagnosis, would not be accurate in finding patients with primary aldosteronism. As opposed to, say, somebody with cortisol excess, we know that to produce enough cortisol to have clinical manifestations of Cushing's, you have to have a sizable nodule, commonly above 1.5 or even 2 centimeters. In primary aldosteronism, you can have severe PA that occurs from really teeny tiny lesions. And coming back to a point you made earlier, which was that these patients were diagnosed based on pathological diagnosis. Actually, this is a point that they did not have in this study. And so we did not have even clinical pathology, but we should also remind our listeners that since 2014, we have very specific human antibodies against CYP11B2 or aldosterone synthase. And since we've used those antibodies, still we only do this primarily in research for now. Some clinical laboratories have now implemented immunostaining with CYP11B2. We know that the areas that produce aldosterone excessively don't always correspond with what we see on CT scans. So even within the adrenal that is removed, we might find a non-functioning nodule that is the dominant nodule and the nodule that was captured by CT, and yet the cells that produce aldosterone might be in smaller nodules or discrete areas within the adrenal cortex.
Yes, good. Thank you for that overview. And yeah, and thanks for clarifying that. Yeah, that the outcome that was used here was based on biochemical, not pathological, biochemical or clinical improvements with the blood pressure. Good. Mm-hmm. So a few of the limitations that the authors list here is a few different things. So one that they say that given that these studies were done at large centers, this may not be applicable to the general population, that they have a relatively narrow group of individuals here. And so that may be harder to apply to other centers and other patients in general. They also point out that white patients were overrepresented in this study, so there may be some limitations in broadly applying these results there as well. They also point out that there is a possible selection bias since part of the study was retrospective and part of it was prospective. And another thing that they point out that there's no accepted criteria for bilateral primary aldo is that a lot of folks have different opinions on that, and so it's hard to reach a consensus, and depending upon which definition you use, you may have come up with different results on that. So a few different limitations that we would add to that. One is one that we've mentioned before is that when they've evaluated the outcomes again and those who underwent surgery and then basing that on the biochemical or clinical, the blood pressure response after having had that surgically proven unilateral PA, I think that does limit somewhat the conclusions. But again, I think, and similar to what Adina pointed out before, is that I think if anything, this is going to, if they included that, would make it less impressive results. So we're already concluding that the results with imaging are not that helpful. I think they'd be even less so if you stepped back and included a broader group and wasn't based on the AVS there. Adina, you had some other thoughts though, particularly about the data, and you'd mentioned some components of the in-office blood pressure measurement limitations.
Yeah, these again reflect the usual practices, not common just to this study, but to any study that is retrospectively conducted in populations with PA, because follow-up is not standardized across centers yet. So one problem is that we're not really given the information about how many patients only have biochemical versus clinical data. I see in results that we are given stratified data for those who have clinical cure improvement, CT positive versus CT negative, but we are not given sufficient information other than in methods where we are told that a one cure criterion would have been biochemical cure, yet we don't see any data on biochemical outcomes in this population at all. And then we spoke about the limitations of office blood pressure measurements. Ideally, you should have at home blood pressure measurements with standardized equipment. Obviously, this couldn't have been done in retrospective studies. And we know about white coat syndrome and other reasons for having different blood pressures in the office versus the stable blood pressure at home.
Great, thanks. And finally, the author's strengths. So one, they point out that this is a large data set, though I would just reiterate it as before, is the actual number of subjects whose data could be included in the final analysis was a much smaller fraction of the overall large data set, but still several hundred patients. So definitely a large data set there. And they point out as a strength that they utilize a conclusive diagnosis of unilateral disease as that gold standard reference, again, based on that the biochemical or blood pressure response. And I think almost always with these studies, depending on how you think about these things, your strengths can be your weaknesses. So I agree here that it is a strength that they're using very robust criteria here to try to define that. But again, potentially a weakness because you're only able to analyze individuals who underwent a surgery and that you've, out of necessity, had to exclude all those individuals who didn't with this as your gold standard reference. So what we'll end with here is the author's summary and some of their implications. I will just give those to you, and then we'll think about those as a group. So first of all, what the authors have labeled as their summary is simply, imaging did not provide an accurate detection of primary aldosteronism in general. And some of their listed implications from that is number one, is that finding no or bilateral nodules does not exclude unilateral PA. And second is that imaging alone would deny 40% of patients curative surgery. And next is that imaging missed unilateral primary aldo in 22% of patients who had surgery. And next, that 6% of patients would have undergone surgery unnecessarily. And finally, another one of their hypotheses that they were looking at is that negative imaging does not imply a worse outcome following AVS-guided surgery. So we'll come back to some of these implications and perhaps suggest some of our own here in a second. But before we do that, I wanted to get Salila and Adina's thoughts on just the quality of this report overall. So what is your impression with the quality of the data in this investigation?
I would say that despite the intrinsic limitations of a retrospective cross-sectional study, although I'm kind of debating if we should call it a retrospective cohort study only because there was, you know, the time between diagnosis and follow-up. It's a short time, but nevertheless, I would fully agree with the conclusions of the study, and they do align really well with other published reports that suggest that the accuracy of CT scan is really low in detecting aldosterone-producing adenomas, and just in general for subtyping of PA. And there are two major problems that a patient could come into if they were to be sent to surgery based on CT findings. One is that patients with a chance for PA cure, so those who would have small lesions that would be found functionally with adrenal vein sampling, not necessarily the lesions, but indicate lateralization of PA, could be denied a chance to cure if they were to rely on CT in cases where CT was showing no nodules at all or bilateral findings, either hyperplasia or bilateral nodules. And the second is that some patients who might have a single solitary nodule on one of the two adrenal glands might in fact have either bilateral PA or even unilateral PA occurring from the other side from a smaller lesion, and the dominant nodule would be a non-functioning adenoma. And it would be a tragedy to set the patient to have the wrong adrenal gland removed and yet have, you know, go through the risks of surgery and not benefit from any clinical improvement after that procedure.
So Lila, what are your thoughts on this report overall?
Yeah, I had similar thoughts to what Adina just articulated. And although there are limitations to retrospective studies, it did kind of confirm what we all have witnessed clinically and what prior studies have demonstrated, is that, you know, imaging is not as useful for defining whether somebody has a unilateral lesion that can be cured surgically. And I think it does actually further bolster what we are doing clinically, which is getting AVSs on patients before operating on them. And which was, you know, they brought that up in their introduction, that that has, is what is happening clinically in most centers now, is that patients have AVS or referred to a tertiary center for AVS prior to having adrenalectomy. And, you know, it was initially in the introduction, I think the question is this too much of a hurdle, and would imaging be enough? And I think what they've shown is that, like other studies in the past, is that imaging, it may actually not only not be enough, but may push us in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think so. And this is, it was trying to answer a really important question of, can we simplify this? We've got to figure out a way to simplify this. So it was a question that needed to be asked. And I think we have to agree with the authors here, is that unfortunately, this is at least not the way. There may be other ways to simplify it, but this does not appear to be the way to do that. So where I wanted us to end then is going back to the idea of the implications. The authors put several there, and I think in some ways those were more detailed summaries of their finding. So one implication I would like us to think about, at least based on this data, is whether there is any role for imaging. So if imaging is really not helpful and is maybe only slightly better than a coin toss, leaving aside the particular scenario that Adina outlined before, and particularly young patients where incidentalomas are very uncommon, is there much of or any role outside of that based on this data? So Lila, why don't we start with you, getting your thoughts on that, and then Adina, we'll end with you on what role imaging has based on this information.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And it really boils down to, I think, the clinical characteristics of the individual patient, because there are patients, and the younger they are, the more likely I would feel that imaging is required. In somebody, as they're getting older, the likelihood or the incidence of adrenal adenomas goes up. So I'm not sure how much of a role the imaging plays. You know, if you think that there are two sources of hyperfunction, then imaging should definitely be pursued. If you think somebody has Cushing's and primary aldo, to make sure there isn't an ACC or some other issue happening. So I think it what this has led me to think is what I probably was thinking before I read the paper, which is that we may be overusing imaging in some patients with a primary aldosteronism if we're going to pursue AVS anyway, and maybe to base it more on the clinical scenario as opposed to just getting adrenal imaging on cross-sectional imaging on every patient.
Yeah, so I agree. The basis of recommending cross-sectional imaging before AVS in these patients from the Endocrine Society guidelines is to exclude patients who might have an aldosterone-producing adrenal cancer. Now, adrenal cancer to begin with is extremely rare, but it can be fatal and has a very poor prognosis. And particularly ACCs that make aldosterone, they're just a handful, so not too many. So you wonder if cost is worth it there. Now, the second point that Lila alluded to is actually a potential co-secretion of cortisol. So there are some data out there that suggest that cortisol co-secretion in patients with primary aldo can be as frequent as maybe 25%. And if we do see a sizable nodule in this patient's on imaging, we must pursue hormonal testing for subclinical hypercortisolism. Why? Because if that is present, that can skew the interpretation of the adrenal vein sampling results. So we didn't speak much about the details of interpreting adrenal vein sampling data, but we always use cortisol not only to make sure that the catheters are placed in the adrenal veins correctly, but also to quote unquote normalize aldosterone values to an adrenal biomarker. And traditionally, we have always used cortisol for this. And this information is critical for knowing if we can rely on adrenal vein sampling hormonal data or not. And then lastly, occasionally, we do use imaging in conjunction with adrenal vein sampling if we have partially successful adrenal vein sampling. Say we went into one adrenal vein, and in that adrenal vein, we find that the aldosterone secretion is actually below what we measure in periphery. That is suggestive of suppression of aldosterone from that side. Then we can assume, we might not be right, but we can assume that the opposite adrenal gland is the source of aldosterone excess. And then if on cross-sectional imaging, we also see a nodule that kind of reinforces our hypothesis. The opposite, however, is not true. So if we see a really high gradient between that adrenal vein that was successfully catheterized and periphery, there is no threshold that could make us confident that that is the source of aldosterone excess. So there could be situations where imaging might guide our management, either in conjunction with adrenal vein sampling or independently, for sure in patients with adrenal cancer, only that we luckily don't find those very often.
And with that, I would like to thank Salila Kura and Adina Turku for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did and will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.